Okay, first of all, Erev Tov, next week is...
Thursday.
It's Thursday, but I cannot remember who's coming. So, in 2 weeks is Rabbi Ovi Jacob, Rabbi's son-in-law. Next week, it's definitely a good one, but I don't remember at the moment. Maybe at the end. I'd like to welcome again Yeshua Katz. I could almost say Rabbi Yeshua Katz now. Finished smicha and will be entering the Kol El Yom of YU. And I thank him each and every time. And without further ado, Yeshua.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Freeman. Good evening, everybody. So tonight we're going to discuss a comparison and a contrast between three different calls for change that we've seen throughout Sefer Bamidbar. One in this week's parasha, Benos Tzlav Chad, one from a few weeks ago, Korach, and one from a few weeks before that in Pesach Sheni, Parshas Ba'alozcha. So in order to do that, let's just first refresh ourselves with some of the main facts, some of the main narrative and story about Benos Tzlav Chad from this coming week's parasha from Parshas Pinchas. So in source number one, Vatekravna Benos Tzlav Chad, Ben Chifer, Ben Gilad, Ben Melchir, Ben Menashev, Ben Mishbuchos, Ben Hashev, Ben Yosef, Ve'ilash Mos Ben Osav, Machlan Oa, Ve'chogla, Umilka, Ve'sirtza. Okay, so Tzlav Chad had five daughters. And they came close. We don't know yet what in what manner. So the psukim continue to describe. But ha'amuna lefnei Moshe, so they stood before Moshe, lefnei Elazar hakohen, lefnei ha'nesiim chol ha'ida, in front of Elazar and the Nesiim and the entire nation. Pesach olam moed lemor. Avinu meis bamidbar. So this is their claim. This is Benos Tzlav Chad's claim. Here's the main pasuk. Our father died in the desert. Vehu lo haya besoch ha'ida ha'noadim al Hashem ba'adas korach. He, Tzlav Chad, was not part of the assembly that gathered together, Al Hashem probably means against Hashem in this case, Ba'adas Korach, as part of the assembly of Korach, Kivechat Omis, for rather, he died on account of his own sin, Uvanim Lo Hayula, and he didn't have any of his own sons. And then they say, Lama Yigarashim Avinu Mitoch Mishpachta, why should the name of our father be withheld from the larger family of his, ki ein lo bein, just because he doesn't have a son, so give us an inheritance, give us a portion in Eretz Yisrael, together with our uncles, together with the brothers of our father, Tzlav Chad. And then vayakriv Moshe, mishpatan lefnei Hashem, so Moshe brings their claim before Hashem, and then in the next couple of psukim, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, kein benos Tzlav Chad doveros, right, benos Tzlav Chad are correct, they've spoken properly, and therefore I'm going to respond by gratifying their request, and they get the land that they desire. And in addition to that, so we learn about all of the laws of inheritance that apply in general to Jewish inheritance. Okay, so that's basically just a refresher of what happens in the story of Benos Tzlav Chad. So the first thing I'd like to do is kind of narrow our lens, kind of zoom in a little bit on one very specific point in the formulation that Benos Tzlav Chad make in front of Moshe and Elazar and the Nesiim, and ask a rather simple question, but I think a compelling question. So if you take a look back at Chaf Zayin Gimel in source number one, the third pasuk, what I said was the main pasuk. So what's Benos Tzlav Chad's claim? So there's really three portions to the claim. There are three components of the claim. It goes like this: Avinu Meis Bamidbar. That's component number one. Meaning to say, that Benos Tzlav Chad are trying to convince Moshe, are trying to make an argument for why they deserve some land. So they have to provide some background as to why that's justified. Why do they deserve some land? Why should they have some land? They're not coming from nowhere. There has to be some basis to their claim. So there are three elements to their claim. Avinu Meis Bamidbar. So Tzlav Chad is deceased. He's no longer here. So therefore, he can't be the one to get the land. Then, component number two, V'hu lo haya b'soch ha'ida no'adim al Hashem ba'adas korach ki v'chet omis. He wasn't part of the, again, of the assembly, of part of Korach's rebellion against Hashem and against Moshe Rabbeinu, ki v'chet omis, because he died on account of his own sin. That's number two. And then number three is, uvanim lo hayu lo, he didn't have any sons. So I understand very well why component number one and component number three are necessary to the claim of Benos Tzlav Chad. If they want to have land, so they have to prove that the land shouldn't be going to a different address. The other address would have been their father. Had their father been alive, so he would have been part of the Yotzei Mitzrayim who are now coming into Eretz Canaan, and therefore he would have merited a portion in Eretz Yisrael. But now that he's dead, so he's no longer here to get that portion. So therefore his portion has to go to someone else in the family. So I understand that. Component number three, which is Uvanim Lo Hayulo, so that I also understand. Because what we're about to find out in the coming Psukim is that Jewish inheritance follows the male descent, right? It follows the male lineage. So first you go towards the son, before you get to a daughter. So therefore, had there been any sons, had Tzlafchad had any sons, then Benos Tzlafchad wouldn't have had any claim because the land would have just gone to the sons. So therefore, I understand number one of Avinu Mis Bamidbar. I understand number three, Uvanim Lo Hayulo. What I don't understand is number two. Why is it the case that Benos Tzlafchad have to mention that Tzlafchad was not part of Adas Korach Kivechet Onis? Why do they have to emphasize to Moshe Rabbeinu as part of the basis, as part of the justification for their claim, that Tzlafchad didn't join in Korach's rebellion? What's the relevance of Tzlafchad's remaining separate from Korach's rebellion and instead dying on account of his own sin? What's the relevance of that statement to Benos Tzlafchad's general request for land in Eretz Yisrael? That's the question. So it's not my question. Chazal were already privy to this question. And the Mefarshim were as well. So let's take a look at one classical answer, which is formulated nicely by the Ibn Ezra and also expounded upon in the Medrash. And then we're going to pose another question on that answer, and then we're going to jump to the Ramban's answer, which is going to be kind of the springboard for our discussion tonight. So the first answer is like this. The Ibn Ezra says in source number two, "V'hu lo haya chashvu abanos ki lo yirishu b'nei hanoadim al Hashem." So Benos Tzlafchad thought that those who gather against Hashem, those who rebel against Hashem, as part of a general klal, as part of a community of rebels, so they wouldn't merit an inheritance in Eretz Yisrael. So if that's the case, then that works very nicely. That maintains the assumption of our question, right? What was the assumption of our question? We assumed that whatever Benos Tzlafchad were saying was going to be relevant to getting a portion in Eretz Yisrael. And Ibn Ezra says, you're right, that it is relevant. And I'll explain to you why it's relevant that Tzlafchad wasn't part of Adas Korach. Because had he been part of Adas Korach, then he would have been part of an assembly that rebelled against Hashem. And were he part of an assembly that rebelled against Hashem, then he would have lost his portion in Eretz Yisrael. Oh, that's Ibn Ezra's answer. In fact, the Medrash Haggadah expounds upon that, as I said before. Source number three, Avinu Meis Bamidbar, V'hu Lo Haya B'Soch Ha'ida. So it basically, if you look back at the Pasuk, again, in Chav Zayin Gimel, that primary Pasuk, that linchpin, Avinu Meis Bamidbar, V'hu Lo Haya B'Soch Ha'ida, Hano Adim Al Hashem Ba'adas Korach. The Pasuk, within just a couple of words, repeats the word Eida, or the verb form of Eida, three times. V'ulo haya b'socha Eida, number one. Hano adim al Hashem, number two. Ba'adas Korach, number three. So the Medrash is perturbed. It's bothered by why there should be such repetitious language in this formulation. And what it does is that it darshins, it expands, it extrapolates three different groups of rebellion that existed during the time of the Midbar and inserts them into each of these three instances of the word Eida. So the Medrash does is like this. Avinu Meis Bamidbar, V'ulo haya b'socha Eida, I mean source number three. So what's b'socha Eida, the first Eida? Elu adas miraglim. So that's the first group that rebelled against Hashem, the Meraglim, who declined to enter Eretz Yisrael. Hano adim al Hashem, those who assembled against Hashem, elu hamislonim, from Parshas Baaloscha, right? Those who complained in the Midbar because they didn't have enough food and drink. Ba'adas Korach kimashma'o. So that's the simple interpretation. Adas Korach, we know Adas Korach. L'lamencha, so what's the pasuk coming to teach us by repeating all three of these? Shekol elu lo natlu chelek ba'aretz. All three of these groups, all three of these groups did not receive any portion in Eretz Yisrael. So what the Ibn Ezra said just about Adas Korach, that Benos Tzlafchad were concerned that those who assembled against Hashem would lose their portion, so that's That's bolstered by the Medrash that applies it past Adas Korach, beyond Adas Korach, to three groups of public rebellion. The Meraglim, the Mislonanim, and Korach. So again, just to repeat something we've already said. If this is the case, so then we can very much understand Chav Zayin Gimel. We can understand all three components. Avinu Meis, okay. Uvanim Lohayulo, we explained that before. Now, what's the relevance of Adas Korach? Because were Tzlafchad part of Adas Korach, then he would have lost his right to inheritance, and Benos Tzlafchad would not have had any basis for their claim. So it seems like a fine explanation, and it certainly is. The only problem is that it seems to deviate somewhat from the simple interpretation of the Pasuk. Because Benos Tzlafchad don't mention any of the other assemblies. They only talk about Adas Korach. They go out of their way, even if, for example, let's say like this, even if we take the approach of the Medrash and we insert into the Pasuk all three of these different groups, we're still left with a question. And that's, why did Benos Tzlafchad single out Korach? Why did they make an explicit reference to Korach, even if it's the case that they're really referring to all three? Yeah?
Why would they say it's if it was the case that they were part of one of these three groups, would be attached to them?
Well, I mean, the flip side is what they're trying to say, right? Meaning, had he been part of those groups, then he would have lost his right. Well, so therefore, they have to say he wasn't. Sorry?
And they wouldn't have asked anything. So obviously, he was not part of the group. I mean, there's a negative inference also that you can make of it. But, all right.
You're saying, had he actually been part of the group, then this story wouldn't have existed in the Torah. Right, but I guess what they're trying to build some evidence for their claim, trying to say what motivates our claim, right? What gives us the basis. So all my point is just, given that it's relevant, because it's here, so my point is just, why do they have to make explicit reference to Korach, even if they're trying to mention the other groups as well? And also, that's really kind of more of a midrashic interpretation, but on the simple level in the Pasuk, all they mention is Korach. Yeah?
And what about the opposite? Keep Chet or Meis.
Ah, okay.
Right.
So why do they have to say both sides?
Right.
That could be coming for emphasis, or it could be coming for to make an additional point. It's a good. There are certainly the Midrashim talk about that as well. Let's see if we'll come back to that. Yeah. Okay. So where we stand right now is a question on the approach of the Medrash and the Ben Ezra as to why, if it's the case that the Pasuk mentions all three of these groups, why is it that Benos Tzlafchad would make explicit reference and try to highlight Adas Korach? So here's where the Ramban comes into the picture. And the Ramban, in his classic form, speaks about the Derech HaPshat in addition to the other ways of interpreting the Pesukim. And he has a really breakthrough interpretation here that, as I said before, I think can serve as a kind of foundation for the continuation of our discussion tonight. So let's read the Ramban inside, source number 4. V'da'ati b'Derech HaPshat, says the Ramban. My opinion, according to the simple interpretation, Sha'amru kacha, they said like this, meaning they mentioned Korach, Ba'avur shechashvu shemosh rabino hayasone adas Korach yoser mikol hachoteim shemesu bamidbar. Because they were under the impression that Moshe Rabbeinu had more hatred, had more contempt for Adas Korach more than any other group of sinners who died, who perished in the Midbar. Why? Why is that the case? Why did Adas Korach strike a chord with Moshe Rabbeinu? Shehim hayu hakamim kenegdo v'hakofrim b'chol ma'asav. Because they had the most intense, direct rebellion against Moshe. They were kamim kenegdo, I'll come back to that. They stood up against him, and they denied all of the positive deeds that he did on behalf of Klal Yisrael throughout the years in the Midbar. V'chashvu, so now coming back to Benos Tzlafchad, what was their thought process? Ulai b'sinaso osam, maybe because of Moshe's contempt for Adas Korach, yomar al yihilo Moshe chesed v'al yihi chonei liyisomav yizacher avon avusam el Hashem. Ramban quoting a pasuk from Tehillim just as a way of formulating his point. Essentially what the Ramban is saying is that Benos Tzlafchad were concerned that perhaps because of Moshe's intense contempt for Adas Korach, therefore he would say that none of Korach's descent should have, or no one who is involved in Korach's assembly, in Korach's rebellion, should have any Moshe chesed. No one should extend any kindness towards them. No one should provide favor for his orphans, for those who came after. Yizacher avon avosam el Hashem. That sin should always be remembered. Al kein hodiuhu ki lo hayamehem. So says the Ramban that as a result, on account of this concern that Benos Tzlafchot had, therefore they went out of their way to tell Moshe Rabbeinu, guess what? Tzlafchot was not part of Adas Korach. But the question is, what was the basis for this concern? Let's add another point here. We know in general from the Torah and from the way Chazal interpret that from when we say Pokid Avon Avos Al Banim, when we have a concept that Hashem exacts punishment on future generations on account of earlier generation sins. So usually we limit that principle to a case where the sin still exists in the future generations, meaning future generations are carrying on the sin that was perpetrated, that was done by earlier generations. So therefore, they're not only held accountable for themselves, but also for their earlier ones. Obviously, that's a philosophical topic, not our topic for tonight. But be it as it may, we usually limit that to when the sin still exists, it persists. In this case, Benos Tzlafchot had nothing to do with Adas Korach. They're coming to Moshe Rabbeinu as total loyal people, right? All they want is an inheritance in Eretz Yisrael. They're not coming as rebels. They're not participating. They didn't participate in Adas Korach. So Korach's sin doesn't even exist now. So why are Benos Tzlafchot worried that Moshe Rabbeinu will kind of exact revenge on or kind of hold a grudge against all future generations from people who existed as part of Adas Korach, even if Tzlafchot participated in Korach's rebellion? Nonetheless, his daughters didn't. So why should they be concerned for their father's sin? And in addition to that, just what is it about Korach's sin that really causes Benos Tzlafchot concern? So I'd like to suggest, yeah.
Well, I think it's natural to some extent that they're concerned that it would look similarly like a challenge to Moshe Rabbeinu's.
Okay, exactly. That's exactly where I want to go. So that's what I was about to say. So thank you. Okay, so what Will says is exactly on target. Well, that's exactly where I was going. I think what the Ramban is hinting to here, if not stating outright, but at least hinting to, is that Benos Tzlafchot had an inner concern that what they were doing, their action, appeared on its surface as similar to the action of Korach. Both are coming as groups calling for change. There's a certain status quo that confronts them. They're dissatisfied with the status quo, and they want to change it. So Korach says, "Ki cholo eda kulam kedoshim," right? Why can't we have something? Why does it all get? Why is it limited to Moshe and Aaron? And Benos Tzlafchot say, "Why can't we have an inheritance?" So on the surface, Benos Tzlafchot see that their call for change, again on the surface, is very similar to that of Korach, and therefore they go out of their way to say to Moshe Rabbeinu that Korach doesn't run in our family. That's not what we're doing here, right? We're doing something totally different. Our call for change is fundamentally distinct from what Korach was trying to do. Don't group us together with Korach. No, we're different. Yeah, Mrs. Friedman.
Thank you. But the fact is that they don't say we're not like Korach. They say their father's not like Korach. Why do they have to bring him into it at all? They could just say we're not doing what Korach wanted to do. Why does it have to have any effect?
Okay, good question. So that's why I use the phrase doesn't run in the family. Because what they're trying to say is that if our father was part of Adas Korach, so you might be concerned that like kind of trickles down to us, that we're affected, we're influenced by the way by our family's previous history. And they're trying to say no, like we're totally distinct from that, and our father was too.
And that's why they emphasize Kibbutz Hatametz.
Yeah, right. So coming back to that point, that's the emphasis, right? It's totally, this is independent, right? It's totally isolated. It's an isolated kind of occurrence for Korach. Yeah. But if this is correct, right, if Will is right, if I'm right, so then we have to ask a further question, because what really is the difference between Binos Tzlavchad and Korach? After all, if we just stop right here, isn't it true that they're just both coming to ask for change? So what accounts for the difference? Why is it that Binos Tzlavchad are so different from Korach? Yeah.
They're saying Lama Yigarashim are being told Mishpachto. They're asking for change about something that impacts the legacy of their father. It's not just for power for themselves.
Oh, very good. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that. Make sure I come back to that, but I'm going to. So, in order to kind of organize or characterize the analysis that I think can further this approach, I'm going to characterize it along three different categories. All M categories. So we're going to talk about their motivation, we're going to talk about their manner, and we're going to talk about their mechanism. Okay, what prompted Binos Tzlavchad to do this? What was the way in which they did it? And what was the mechanism? What was the approach they used in order to succeed at their task? So let's begin with the first. With regard to motivation. So that really goes to my mother's point. Right? For Korach, we know from the Psukim basically themselves, and certainly from Divrei Chazal, that Korach was really selfishly focused. Right? He wanted power for himself. He was upset that the Melucha and the Kahuna, the leadership was limited to the realm of Moshe and Aaron, and he thought that he should come before some of the descendants of Moshe and Aaron, and therefore he started a rebellion, which he couched in other terms. Right? He made it seem like this was a righteous rebellion, ki chol ha'edah kulam kedoshim, but in truth, at essence, what really lied behind that couching was his interest, his self-interest, an interest in power, an interest in control. So, in stark distinction to that, we have Binos Tzlavchad. So, let's take a close look at the Psukim. Let's read the words carefully. What happens in Binos Tzlavchad? So, look at Pasuk Gimel. When they make their actual claim, they almost barely make reference to themselves. What do they say? Avinu meis bamidbar. So right from the start, the focus, the subject, is their father Tzlavchad. Vehu lo haya besocha eda hanoadim al Hashem ba'adas Korach ki vechet omis. So far, everything is about Tzlavchad. Uvanim lo hayu lo. It seems a little bit strange that the pasuk keeps on referring to Tzlavchad over and over again. Then in pasuk dal, lama yigarashim avinu mitoch mishpachto. It's not even our mishpacha; it's his mishpacha. It's all about Tzlavchad. Ki ein lo bein tana lanu achuza besocha chay avinu. So the one exception to that is tana lanu achuza, but that just seems to be like a technicality. Meaning that's the actual request. There's no other way to make that request. But it's besoch achay avinu. Right? It's not like not together with our uncles. It's together with our father. Now, it's not. I'm not saying that's a kind of muhrach type of diuk. It's not. This is not something that could go without questioning. But I think at least stands out how much in two psukim Binos Tzlavchad make reference to their father, even if it's not with regard specifically to their request. So that's number one. Number two. So Chazal comment that Binos Tzlavchad. So why at the very beginning in Pasuk Aleph, why do we go through their ancestry? Binos Tzlavchad ben Chifer ben Gilad ben Machir ben Menasheh lemishpachos Menasheh ben Yosef. So Chazal comment that it's because just as Yosef expressed a love for Eretz Yisrael, so too Binos Tzlavchad cherished Eretz Yisrael and therefore wanted an inheritance there. So what was Yosef's expression of love? So he wanted his bones carried to be buried in Eretz Yisrael from Mitzrayim. So too, Binos Tzlavchad, look at what they're coming to do. The reason why, their motivation for asking for an inheritance in Eretz Yisrael is because of their love for the land. It has nothing to do with themselves. It's altruistic. It's righteous. They're asking for something for their father, for the continuation of their father's name and legacy within his family. And in addition to that, they're also asking for a religious and spiritual connection to the land. All of which stands in clear contrast to Korach's motivation. So that's the first category. I think that emerges very clearly. The second one is in terms of manner. And this is also very clear just in the psukim themselves. If you go to source number 5, so when the psukim describe how Korach organizes his rebellion, so it says Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kahas, and then in Pasuk Beis, Vayakumu lifnei Moshe ha'anoshim b'bnei Yisrael chamishim u'masayim. So they get up before Moshe Rabbeinu. They stand up before him. The lashon of Vayakumu seems to be one that is that is kind of like provocative. It's like you're trying to start something. And then in the next pasuk, Vayakhilu al Moshe v'al Aharon. They gather together against Moshe and Aaron. And just to remind ourselves of the term that the Ramban used when he described what Korach did with his assembly, he said Shehim Hayu Hakamim Kenegdo, using the same language of Vayakumu Lifnei Moshe. Because that term of Vayakumu is conveying, it's portraying the way in which, the manner in which Korach called for change. And then in contrast to that, on the other hand, if you go to Benos Tzlavchad in source number 1, so what does it say? Vatikravna Benos Tzlavchad ben Chefer ben Gilad. They come close. It's not a language of Vayakumu. It's a lashon of Kiruv, of Vatikravna. And then in the next pasuk, Vata'amudna lefnei Moshe. They stand before Moshe. Meaning they stand firmly in their place. They're making a serious argument, but it's done in a peaceful manner. They're not doing it in a rebellious manner. They're not doing it in an antagonistic manner. They're not trying to start up a fight of Vayakumu and Vayakilu, but rather Vatikravna Vata'amona. A very clear contrast in the manner in which Benos Tzlavchad and Korach go about their calls for change. And number 3, and perhaps the most important, is the mechanism that Korach and Benos Tzlavchad use and the differences between those two mechanisms. When it comes to Korach, so we're all very familiar with Divrei Chazal quoted by Rashi in terms of what Korach's argument really was. So Rashi says, Me'asa, source number 6, Amad Vechanas Masayim Chamishim Rashi Sanhedrios. He got 250 of the leaders of the courts, Ruban Mishavit Ruvin Shechinov, and Vechule. And then what does he say to Moshe in the third line in Rashi? Amrulo Tale Shakula Shatcheles Chayeves Bitzitzis O Pituda. Amar Lahem Chayeves. So if you have a talis that's made totally of Tcheles, does it have to have a Tcheles string as well? So Korach asked the question, and then Moshe Rabbeinu said, of course, it's obligated. His chidul nisachik alav. So then they poked fun at him. So Korach makes his own kal v'chomer, right? He says, if there was a talis that was made of another material and one string of tcheles exempts it from its obligation in tzitzis, so what? So a talis that's made fully of tcheles still requires that one string of tzitzis? And this medrash is stated in a number of different ways. We know about the room full of the Sifrei Torah and Sfarim. Does it also need a mezuzah? So he states the argument in many different ways. And the way that the Rav describes Korach's rebellion in one of his essays is as the common sense rebellion. What Korach was trying to do was essentially impose an external logic onto the development of the halacha. He was trying to say that my own logic and intuition leads me to this conclusion. It's very persuasive. It's compelling. You might think like I do. So let's go with it. Let's follow that logic to its conclusion. That's basically Korach's argument. He's saying that the halacha can be decided upon and determined by any layman, as long as he utilizes the proper logic and intuition in that process. That's what the Rav coins the common sense rebellion of Korach. So again, for Korach, what stands out is that his mechanism is an imposition, taking something outside of the Torah self-sufficient logic and sticking it onto what the halachic development should really be. So Benos Tzlavchad, again, in contrast, do something very different. Do something very different. And this really comes up most clearly through the interpretation of Chazal. So the Gemara in Bava Basra, Daf Kuf Yotes Amud Beis, and this is also quoted in some Midrashim, I believe. So they explain what Benos Tzlavchad's argument really was. They say that Benos Tzlavchad were Darshanios, Tzidkanios, and Chachmanios. And the reason why Benos Tzlavchad attained all of these statuses was because they formulated an argument that took already existing Torah logic and basically formulated a kind of question on it. So I think the argument goes as follows, right? They said, if we're considered like children, so then we should really get a portion, right? We should get an inheritance. And if we're not considered like children, really, if like from the perspective of the laws of inheritance, we only pay attention to males, so then our mother should basically should have been up for yibum, and therefore we should have gotten a different inheritance through the uncle, right? Through Slavchad's brother. So essentially, that argument is like, it's called a mimanavshach, right? Either this way or that way. No matter how you look at it, we deserve an inheritance. So, but what Benoth, my point here is not necessarily like the technicalities and ins and outs of that argument. The point is that Benoth Slavchad were in tune with the halachic development. They were in tune with how the halacha works, and they were coming and making an argument based off of that. They were making a further application of the halacha, and therefore basically trying to use the inner logic of the halacha, the self-sufficient logic of the Torah, and then applying it to a new circumstance, taking it to a new level, taking it to a new stage. And that's in contrast to Korach, who's trying to impose an external logic onto the Torah. So it's the external logic versus the inner logic. And I think
the external logic.
The external logic point for Korach is what I was saying about the Rav with the common sense rebellion, right? Which I quoted from Rashi. That as long as, like, if you have an argument that appeals to our common sense and our intuition, so then we should follow it all the way until its conclusion. And therefore, we made fun of Moshe Rabbeinu, who said, yeah, the talus full of tchilas needs a string, right? But for Benos Slavchad, they made an argument from within the Torah. Right, they use the laws of inheritance, of Yibum, in order to make a further argument as to why the din, right, why the law should be different. In other words, they were basically trying to apply the law further. They were trying to discover a new element of the law that wasn't yet exposed, so to speak, as opposed to Korach, where the law was sufficient, it was as it was, and Korach trying to change it from the outside. I think that that Rashi really tries to get at this in source number 8. This is, I think this is something that really penetrates this what we're trying to say here. So in the pasuk, let's just go back to the pasuk in order to understand what Rashi's trying to say. So in source number 1, Chaf Zayin Beis, Vata'amuna lifnei Moshe v'lifnei Elazar HaKohen v'lifnei Anisiim v'chol Ha'edah. So the pasuk has a string of different people before whom Benos Slavchad presented themselves. So it's interesting. Like, why does it repeat? Lifnei Moshe, Lifnei Elazar HaKohen, Lifnei HaNesiim, V'chol Ha'edah. Could have just said Kol Ha'edah. Why do I have to say Moshe, Elazar, the Nesiim? So Rashi has two interpretations. First, he says Lifnei Moshe, Ve'achar Kach Lifnei Elazar. Efshar E Moshe Lo Yada Elazar Yodea Elasaris HaMekar V'Darshehu Divrei Rabbi Yoshia. So what does it mean? Basically, it means that they came before Elazar first, and then before Moshe. Even though in the order of the pasuk, it seems like they first went to Moshe, and then Elazar, and then Nesiim, then the entire Eda. But really, that can't be the case, because they understood that if Moshe didn't know the answer, then obviously Elazar wouldn't know the answer. So therefore, Saris HaMekra V'Darshehu. You have to reverse the order, and then interpret it. So what they did was, they first came before Elazar, and then they came before Moshe. I'll come back to that in a second. The second interpretation, Abba Chanan Mishon Rabbi Elazar Omer, Beveis HaMerdesh Hayu Yoshvim V'amdu Lifnei Kulam. Where was the scene, where was the setting of this entire story? In the Beis HaMerdesh. Benos Slavchad stood before all of the people learning in the Beis HaMerdesh in order to discuss this case. So what's Rashi trying to say? Or what's Abba Chanan Mishon Rabbi Elazar trying to say, the Tana? So I think the point is that the setting, the environment, reflects on the nature of the event. Right? Sometimes the setting in which something takes place can affect the character of what is taking place itself. And what Rashi is trying to say is that this argument took place in the Beis HaMedrash. The environment was an environment of Limud Torah. It was an environment in which there was a respect for the development and evolution of halacha, and we're trying to enter that world. We're trying to play a part in that world, as opposed to the argument taking place outside, which would reflect that really there's the Torah that happens in the Beis HaMedrash, and this argument is now being imposed onto it outside. Instead, Rashi is trying to say that Benos Slavchad came into the Beis HaMikdash. What they were doing was they engaged in a halachic give and take, because that was the mechanism that is not only helpful, but also proper, and also authentic and genuine in trying to provide a development for the halacha. I think that also connects to the first interpretation in Rashi. Why are we trying to say that the order in the pasuk was reversed, that first they went to Elazar and then only afterwards to Moshe? Because what that reflects is that Benos Slavchad understood the hierarchy of Torah authority. They understood that first we kind of bring a question for to lower authorities, and then we work our way up, the way that Yisro, in Parshas Yisro, develops the entire court system, where you have lower courts and then higher courts. So too, we first come to the lower authority, but then we recognize that there are higher authorities, and there are different rungs on the ladder. There are different parts of this hierarchy. So Benos Slavchad are coming from a recognition of Torah authority. They're coming to the place of Torah, all of which in order to emphasize and highlight that the nature of their claim, the nature of their call for change, is drastically different from the nature of Korach's call for change. Whereas Korach, in terms of the motivation, manner, and mechanism, a selfish motivation, an antagonistic manner, and an external mechanism, Benos Slavchad of motivation, manner, and mechanism, an altruistic and righteous motivation, a peaceful yet stern manner, and an inner mechanism, working within the confines of the Torah. And when we take all three of those together, so then it becomes perfectly clear why Benos Slavchad sought so much to distinguish themselves and their father from Adas Korach. Because when you see what they're doing on the surface, you might get confused. You might say, why was it that Korach was scorned and Benos Slavchad were responded to as Cain Benos Slavchad Doveros? That this parsha in the Torah, as Chazal say, that they merited to have this parsha in the Torah written on their account, on their behalf. It's included in the Torah because they did so. And Korach was killed, and his entire assembly was killed. What's the difference? So when we really try to analyze all three of these different categories, both in light of the terminology and the formulations in the text, and also in light of the further interpretations of Chazal and the Mefarshim, I think what emerges is a clear fundamental difference between the two that again accounts for that question as to why Benos Slavchad sought so much to distinguish themselves from Korach. The truth is that if this analysis is correct, so then we can apply it even further. And hopefully come to understand another set of parallels between Benos Slavchad and another story in the Torah of Pesach Sheni. So if you go to source number 9, we have a chart that kind of compares the two narratives of Pesach Sheni in Bamidbar Perek Tes and Benos Slavchad in Bamidbar Perek Chav Zayin. We're just going to go through it very quickly, but if you take a look, there are clear, really kind of conspicuous parallels between the two. So you have a group of people who are Tameim, therefore couldn't offer the Korban Pesach. So what's the verb that's used to describe how they approached Moshe? Vayikrvu. So too, as we noted before, Vatikravna Benos Tzlavchad. Pasuk Zayin, Vayomru HaNashim Hahima Eilav. So what was their claim? Anachnu Tameim Lenefesh Adam, Lama Nigara, Livoti Hakrives Korban Hashem Bemoada. Why should we be withheld from offering the Korban of Hashem at its time? Besuch Bnei Yisrael. So too, Benos Tzlavchad, Lama It's asking why we're being withheld from a larger group. We're not talking about ourselves. We're talking about being part of a larger cloud, a larger community. What happens in response to the claim? The same exact thing. Moshe doesn't know the answer. He has to approach Hashem. He can't tell them off the bat. So too for Benos Slavchad. He has to bring this case before Hashem in order to find the answer. He doesn't have the answer himself. And then Rashi provides another two parallels between the two stories. Just as we said, the Benos Slavchad takes place in the setting of the Beis HaMedrash, so too, Bamidbar Perek Tes, Lefnei Moshe v'Lefnei Aaron, says Rashi, Kisheshneihem Yoshvin Beveis HaMedrash Ba'u Ushe Alum. They came to the Beis HaMedrash in order to pose this question. And in addition to that, as I referenced kind of slightly before. So Rashi says that in both cases, the reason why these parshios were written in the Torah was as a schus, as a privilege and a merit for the protagonists in these cases. So Rashi says with regard to Pesach Sheni, v'ru'ula ha'isa parsha zo le'ha'amer ayedei Moshe kishar kol ha'Torah kula. Really, Moshe should have been the one to record all of the laws of Pesach Sheni, but instead, ela shezachu ela shatei'amer ayedeihen, this group of people, the Temeim, who came before Moshe in order to ask for an opportunity to offer the Korban Pesach, so they merited that this parsha would be recorded on their behalf. Shemegalgalin zechus al yedei zakai, because we roll a zechus with the zakai. Meaning, if someone merits something, so then the zechus should be in his name. So too Rashi with regard to Benos Slavcha, Davar Acher, Ruya Haisa Parsha Zoli Hikasiv al yedei Moshe. It should have been recorded just plainly, the way the rest of the Torah, for the most part, is as Moshe speaking to Klal Yisrael. But Benos Tzlavchad merited to have this parsha recorded in their name because of their positive action. So what's the connection between Pesach Sheni and Benos Tzlavchad? So again, they come. What's their manner? Vayikrevu. They come in a peaceful way. What's their motivation? Lama nigara b'so mitoch mishpachto. Lama nigara levelti akrives k'bar Hashem amado b'so panei Yisrael. They want to offer a korban. They're not seeking something for themselves. They're seeking a further relationship with Hakadosh Baruch Hu. They want to offer something to Hakadosh Baruch Hu. Not just something, but the korban Pesach, perhaps the pinnacle of all korbanos throughout the entire year. And in addition to that, what is their mechanism? So Rashi in source number 10 quotes, Lama nigara amar lahem in kachim kriven betuma. You guys can't offer the korban because korbanos cannot be offered in a state of tuma. So amru lo, so what do they respond? Yizarik hadam alenu bekohanim tahorim v'yeochel habasar l'tahorim. So fine, so we won't be part of the kind of inner process. The blood will be sprinkled by pure people, and the korban, the meat, will be eaten by pure people, but at least it will be done on our behalf so that it will be accredited to us, and we will be able to further our relationship with Hashem and fulfill this mitzvah. So again, they're working within the confines of the Torah. That's, they're working within the Beis HaMikdash. Sorry?
But at the end of the day, they wanted a place to shake.
Well, I mean, for their the way that they made their argument was, allow us to have this, and then the response was, no, that's not going to work, but Pesach Sheni instead will. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So just as the parallel here again is that we're not trying to impose an external logic onto the Torah, but rather Benos Tzlavchad and Pesach Sheni both are working within the confines of the Torah in order to accomplish their goals. So I think that the takeaway from here, from this comparison and contrast, is very clear. The point is that there is room for application, evolution, for new understanding of the Torah, of the Halacha, and its further application year after year, generation to generation. But the way in which that has to be done is through the inner logic of the Torah, coming from the Torah values, principles, and precedents, and using those in order to reach further conclusions and apply the Torah in a new way and kind of discover and unveil new elements that weren't necessarily known in the past. But what we can't do is, as we did, as what Aras Korach represented, trying to impose, as the Rav said, the common sense rebellion onto the Torah. So Benos Tzlavchad and Pesach Sheni provide for us kind of the antidote to that. Instead of going in that direction, so instead, make sure that you have an altruistic and righteous motivation, make sure you do it in a peaceful manner, and for sure, make sure that you have a respect for the authority, the hierarchy of authority, and you work within the inner workings of the Torah. Wish everyone a great Shabbos.
Thank you very much. Next week is Rabbi Yaakov Blau.